The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, the manager of the century, Fortune called him upon his retirement. Others referred to him as a rock star CEO, a champion of Six Sigma and Stack rankings. His name became synonymous with consistent and predictable earnings growth and shareholder gains as well, and with M&A, job cuts, offshoring, and outsourcing. We are talking about the man who broke capitalism, or at least that's what a new book calls Jack Welch. Joining us is David Gelis, corner office columnist and award-winning business reporter for the New York Times, author of The Man Who Broke Capitalism, How Jack Welch Gutted the Heartland and Crushed the Soul of Corporate America, and How to Undo His Legacy. David joins us via Zoom in Canada. David, I'm delighted. We've been looking forward to talking with you. This book, would you have written it if Jack Welch was still alive?
Absolutely. It was, you know, sheer timing that he sadly passed away in March 2020, really the week that the pandemic sort of took over in the United States. And that was really the week that helped me realize I needed to write this book. That was my last week of reporting on the Boeing story, which we can talk about in some more detail. Mm-hmm. But absolutely, I wish I had the chance to talk to him about all this, because listen, we know a whole lot about this man, and we know he would have engaged fully in this debate. And it's regretful, frankly, that I wasn't able to, you know, try at least seek out his perspective on all these issues and more.
How did he become someone who was so revered? I've reported on so many GE quarters and on the company over my tenure as a business journalist. I mean, how did he go from being somebody who was, you know, as we said, the manager of the century, and we lauded him for his consistency, to someone who we realized, you know, was doing some financial engineering?
Well, I think that evolution of how we think about him is still very much underway. You know, there are still people who vehemently dispute with my characterization of him. In many corners of the business world, he is still a hero. And that's part of the debate I wanted to stir up, not just a referendum on Welch himself, but a broader conversation about what we admire, what we look up to, the kind of business leaders we want to be putting up on those pedestals. So listen, Welch himself had ups and downs during his tenure. We have to remember, shortly after taking over, he wasn't called the manager of the century. He was called Neutron Jack, because right, everyone was so upset with his mass layoffs and factory closures. But over the course of his 20 years as CEO, he was able to repair that initial damage to his reputation and go out from the company on top. So this, you know, process of thinking about the legacy of a man so consequential, I don't know that it's ever over. And what I'm trying to do with this book is put his tenure in perspective, yes, but also make it a conversation, I hope, about more than just one man, but about a system. And it's a system that, I don't need to tell you both, has created all sorts of bizarre negative externalities and strange consequences and inequalities that we as a society are still wrestling with every day.
Well, David, talk more about that system and, you know, Welch's role in it. I mean, how do we go from the manager of the century into, as you say, the man who broke capitalism?
I think the story for me really begins in the post-war years, actually. That was what some people call the golden age of capitalism. And it was so fun to hear just GE's stock, you know, mentioned in the ticker right before this segment, because GE, it's a reminder, has been this influential bellwether bedrock corporation for more than a century. But back then, in the late 40s, the 50s, the 60s, the way GE treated its employees, the way IBM and Johnson & Johnson treated their frontline employees, was just fundamentally different than the way we think about major multinational corporations treating most of their employees today. Which is to say, back then, in this golden age of capitalism, companies and CEOs were excited about paying people better and better wages. They were eager to share the wealth that they were creating with their employees, with their suppliers, and even with the government. In the book, I cite the 1953 GE annual report, where the company boasts about paying so many taxes. That's a world away from where we are today. And part of the way, a big part of the way we got there, was through the way Welch changed GE. Upon taking over GE in 1981, everything I just described basically went out the window. And Welch brought to the job this maniacal focus on increasing shareholder value and on making GE the most valuable company in the world. And we can talk about the ways right. in which he did it, but it's that change in perspective
right.
that has gotten us from there to here.
One of the things that Jack Welch changed in a very dramatic way was executive compensation, especially when you leave the CEO's office. Just again, we've got about a minute or so. Talk to us about that.
His predecessor at GE, Reg Jones, I forget the exact number, but he was making something close to $1 million a year. That was about 13 times as much as the median employee at GE at the time. Under Welch, CEO compensation began to go upwards, and it really hasn't stopped since then. Just from his work being a manager alone, let's remember GE, Welch was not an inventor, he was not an entrepreneur, he was a people manager. He amassed nearly $1 billion during his tenure, making the list of the Forbes 400 at the time. And when he retired, his exit package was worth some $417 million. Look at the headlines today. That began under Welch. He was a main progenitor of these outsized executive compensation packages, and it really has not stopped to this day. And lots of research demonstrates that it is CEO compensation in particular, executive compensation, that is one of the main drivers of income inequality broadly in this country.
Yeah, and what's interesting too is, and I feel like the connection between shareholder performance, and that was like an okay sign-off on executive compensation that just rose to unbelievable highs, certainly was something you saw under Jack Welch's reign. We're going to continue with David Gelis and his book, The Man Who Broke Capitalism. We'll get back to that in just a moment.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
I want to get back to David Gelis, New York Times reporter, author of a new book, The Man Who Broke Capitalism, How Jack Welch Gutted the Heartland and Crushed the Soul of Corporate America, and How to Undo His Legacy. Quite a turnaround who, for a CEO for many years, was really lauded and respected and imitated, if you will. And he really did spawn a bunch of executives, former GE executives, who went off to lead other companies, although a lot of them, David, didn't do so well. Are we not surprised because a lot of these executives, first of all, didn't have a GE Capital at their beck and call?
Yeah, well, I got to believe that the boards who hired them were surprised. but it's absolutely true. There was really no CEO factory like GE. Fortune 1 wrote that when the Army needs a general, it goes to West Point. And when a company needs a CEO, it goes to GE. And that speaks to not only Welch, but 100 years, really. When GE was revered as sort of the company that set the bar for corporate America. And that continued under Welch. There was a moment in the years just after he retired where there were literally dozens of his proteges running major American corporations.
And I'm curious what the reception to this book has been, because, you know, some pretty harsh words in there. I mean, have you heard from GE? Have you even heard from, you know, Welch's family, for example?
Well, Jeff Immelt, Jack Welch's chosen successor, of course, who I interviewed for this book, he posted a response on LinkedIn, which I would welcome people take a look at, and I wrote a fulsome response back. And so that exchange is really, you know, to me, a recognition that even someone like Immelt is willing to engage in a debate about the real legacy of Welch. And that to me speaks to this broader recognition that men like Welch are really consequential. There are these individuals that sort of serve as inflection points.
Was Immelt defensive of Welch? Just quickly, if you could just tell us how he responded.
Yeah, Immelt, Jeff Immelt, who of course ran GE for the 16 years after Jack, took to LinkedIn and wrote a piece. I think the title was, you know, Jack was pretty damn good or something to that effect. And it was largely a defense of Welch as a manager. Now, my response to Immelt was to essentially look at the way Immelt described Welch in Immelt's own book, which came out last year, in which, I'm sorry, I don't know what words I can use on the radio here. I'll try to be judicious. But Jeff Immelt says that Jack Welch left him a bag of blank. And
well, and it's interesting because Welch was critical, right? The first earnings after he was gone and GE missed a quarterly earnings, Welch was critical.
that was during the financial crisis. And what you just said was an understatement. He said,
yeah,
if Jeff missed again, he would get out a gun and shoot him, which was the way that was the verb Welch used to describe firing people.
So one thing I'm curious about, and you get very much into GE Capital, and again, that was another thing that we said, oh, how great, they've got this finance arm, GE, they're into all these things, they're a microcosm of the economy, but they were actually overexposed to financial. But that, you know, and some of what we're talking about is not new. Like, I think about people who came on and were critical of GE and its consistency and were suspect. You know, there were those certainly naysayers that were out there. When we look back, should somebody have been held accountable? I mean, they did pay some fines, correct? SEC fines later on in terms of, I believe, their accounting. I'm not sure if I'm saying it exactly correctly. But should people have been held accountable for what they were doing? Or what they were doing was, it was legal, but maybe a little squishy.
Well, a lot in there. It's not my job to say how and when we hold executives accountable. And I think it's also important to point out that during the 80s and 90s, there was just much less transparency than there is today. You know, Sarbanes-Oxley was passed after Jack Welch retired. What happened, though, is right after he retired, Bill Gross, who, of course, Mary Childs just wrote a great book about, was among the first to say, you know, this 80 quarters in a row of meeting or beating analyst expectations, like, that doesn't happen naturally. Something is going on here. And then it was several years after that, as you referenced, that under Immelt, GE settled sweeping accounting fraud charges with the SEC that pointed to years and years of impropriety in terms of how they manage the books, how they manage their earnings. So listen, I don't think we can ever know exactly what was going on there. But what is clear, and what Welch's own deputies said on the record then and even to this day, was that GE Capital was the key that let the company, let the parent corporation, meet or beat those analyst expectations quarter after quarter in this most unnatural way. And that they did it with a flurry, you know, within the last week or two of a quarter, just fine-tuning exactly whatever numbers they wanted to, you know, hit the number that they thought the street wanted to see.
And David, I want to talk about the end of the title, how to undo his legacy. Walk us through that.
Well, it's not easy. Listen, we're in a moment, and I've covered CEOs for the last decade or so. You all know this. There's a different ethos in business today. CEOs are talking about their responsibilities and who they serve in new ways. You know, call it stakeholder capitalism, call it CSR, ESG, whatever you want. There's, I think, a broad recognition from companies, from CEOs, from the business roundtable, that this era of shareholder primacy has probably run its course, and that it's time to start considering a whole much broader group of stakeholders. Now, that's easy to say. In practice, it's super hard to do. In the book, listen, I point out some examples of companies that are maybe putting profits, you know, letting them take a backseat in small ways. I call for a laundry list of policy solutions that might gradually start to point us in the right direction. But listen, the last couple years have been a test case. They've been the moment where CEOs, businesses could either step up in the midst of a pandemic, in the midst of now, or, you know, potential another recession, and demonstrate they were going to be serious about this, make good on these lofty commitments. I have yet to see it really happen.
Any lessons learned? We only have about 30 seconds. You have to be quick. Lessons learned, corporate America, SEC, shareholders, analysts, as a result of the Welch era and impact, and just very quickly.
I think that there's a recognition that it works until it doesn't. And if you even talk to boards and CEOs, they understand that if you put someone who's going to follow the Welch playbook and downsize and do a bunch of deals and look for quick earnings, it might work for a couple months, maybe a couple quarters, maybe a couple years, but that kind of strategy just doesn't work in the long term. You got to invest in your people. You got to invest in R&D. You got to make good, reliable products and services. That's the way to make an enduring business in this country.
We didn't get to talk Boeing, so I highly recommend that everybody check out the book because the GE Boeing connection, of course, many executives who ended up there and then getting to the 737 MAX, it's really interesting to read about. David Gelis, good luck with the book, New York Times reporter, and the book is The Man Who Broke Capitalism, How Jack Welch Gutted the Heartland and Crushed the Soul of Corporate America and How to Undo His Legacy.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.